This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
It was like our 30th high school reunion. You know, there was no question that people were interested in my life.
I was just at this point in my life where everything was turning around.
Inside, it was sort of drag, kicking and screaming.
I attempted to get everybody to get up so that I could do something really intimate with us all. Like, I wanted to put people in an inside circle and people in an outside circle and have them look eye to eye to each other and turn the circle and have them have an experience of being with each other.
I was trying to reconnect. I was trying to find some...
No way. Jose, they were not going there. And it was too bad, because I knew that they would have loved it. It would have been the most exciting, satisfying thing that could possibly have occurred. But they weren't ready for it, so.
Hello, welcome. Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller.
From our studio in Sebastopol, California. And this is a show about the trip that got you to wherever you are now, which you probably didn't get from a travel agent.
Two stories today. And you know, it seems as if every successful show has a theme. Talking about the war in Iraq, or how to pot your geraniums.
Or tips on dating an ex-priest. Or the disease of the month and how to make it work for you.
And we fall into this too. We really do.
We do. But this show is about the human zoo. And who really cares if the elephant is located right next to the aardvark? I mean, they're both interesting, right? So today, and maybe more often, we're going to try to do this cold turkey. No themes, just people.
Our first person.
Here's a story from Christina Sukal, who grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and now lives in Northern California. In her 20s, she met Michael, the love of her life, and after 21 years, their marriage dissolved.
There came a point in our marriage where I was growing in a direction that he wished I wasn't and couldn't seem to find an interest in sharing, and so we ended the living together part of our marriage. We stayed lovers, and then we found out he had terminal lung cancer, and he did die this past May. So I found out that you could take care of the body in your own home and never release it to a funeral parlor, and that's the way we treated it, and it was just an extraordinary experience to care for your loved one who is, you know, gone. It was very important. I think as important as getting birth back into the house is getting death back into the house. I didn't live with him during it, so I wasn't present on a daily basis to the process, and he was a very stoic person, and he did not want people around when he was sick, so he went through most of it alone. And he actually took his life. He got to a place where he was so in such pain, and so he was spending 24 hours a day sitting with his head on his hands fighting for the next breath, and it was just excruciating. And he said he just didn't want to go through the rest of what there was to go through. Why, like, he knew he wasn't coming out of it. Why go through more of that torture, becoming incontinent, being emaciated? Why do that? So I was aware that he was going to do that. We spoke about it. I couldn't be with him when he did it. That's one of the amazing things, is that in California, obviously I would have rather be there. I would have rather be there to be with him, to have him go out in a state of love. If I had done that in California, I would have been an accomplice to a crime. So I had to not be there. I had to call the sheriff's office and have them be there first. And so that, I think that's a sin and a crime, that you can't be with your loved ones. I understand the complexities of the process. I understand that, I get it. But anyway, not to go off on that. Where the beauty of that process was for me was that Michael and I had hurt each other a great deal in the last many years of our marriage. And we did come to, like, there was one important thing that happened before he died, which was that we had a really upsetting talk one day, so upsetting that I couldn't believe we were even having it. And the next morning he called me and he said how upsetting it had been for him. And he said, you know, surely we can do better than that. And I said, well, you would think so, wouldn't you? And I went over and we went into a state of love. And the next day I came with the children who were 17 and 15, I guess. And the four of us spent a really loving time together watching home movies, and the children got to know that our love was continuing, real, never, you know, unaltered, even though all these things had happened. So I felt like that made such a difference in their understanding of love, because I feel like for them to have experienced the love that we had so long and so deeply, and then to see that love fail, you know, not have the experience of completion with it, not see us, that the love is still there, and get that this is a part of the love cycle, but it doesn't mean that the love ended or died. When this company called Final Passages that helps you with your dying, your dead, when his body did go to the coroners because he had committed suicide, so they took his body, and it was there over the weekend, and I met with Jerry and looked at a scrapbook she'd put together of people who had taken care of their dead in this way, and I saw they give you a coffin made out of cardboard, and I saw all the ways people had prepared that and decorated it and the ceremony that they'd made, and I all of a sudden got that I could really do something. I could honor Michael. I could do something, you know, personal and beautiful here. And I went home and I thought, well, what were Michael's colors? And I thought, well, they were red and gold and black. So I went and bought spray paint, you know, gold metallic spray paint, and started looking. I found black velvet in my closet, and I spray painted the whole coffin gold and laid the black velvet in the coffin, and then I was looking for something to put on him. He'd lost all his hair by then, and they thought that he might have had an autopsy, so his head might be cut and his body might be cut, and it was like, what are you going to dress him in? And I went looking for a robe, an oriental robe that he'd had that he always looked so fabulous in, and instead I found a prayer robe from Arika that I completely forgot he had, that was this bright red orange and had a hood and tied under the neck, completely covered his baldness. I came home and we just cleaned the temple from top to bottom. We were changing it from ordinary space to sacred space and preparing a place for him. And then when his body came home, we set up a massage table outside, and there's a beautiful piece of music called Graceful Passages that is meant for people who are dying. And we played it and we rang Tibetan bells before taking him out of the body bag. And this red dragonfly showed up, and it is the symbol of Final Passages. It's their symbol is a red dragonfly, and I've never seen one before or since at my house. And I had never been with a dead body. I had no idea what it was going to feel like. It's laid out now on a massage table outside with music playing, and we've said prayers, and now we are pulling the body bag back, not knowing if we're going to encounter a autopsy, you know, or not. And gratefully, they had not done that. And the moment I saw his face, I felt such understanding and such forgiveness and such completion and such love. It was such a privilege to take care of him and to see those sweet feet and to, you know, just honor him. And and then we dressed him in that robe and we put him in this casket, and I had a night when I let those who were close to Michael come and be with him, and my son, you know, was there and took part in it. And I know it contributed to my son's experience of who he is. So I think that this way of dealing with death is something that all of us who are moving towards that, you know, our parents are dying, our friends are dying. I mean, I'm not there yet, but that I'm 53, so I'm now in the years where, you know, we are going to see more and more and more of those we love die. And how do you serve them and yourself powerfully with that process?
Thank you, Christina.
In Sebastopol, California, we were talking with Christina Sukal.
And our next story. What do these two people have in common, okay? There are two human beings on planet Earth examining small bits of their lives. And in the time-honored tradition of the broadcast media, maybe I should say the blindingly obvious, that with both, I talked with them about an hour or so, other stories, long expanses of life, and, oh, no, just got 10 minutes or so, so we're going to leave all that out.
We have to leave out so much. But one thing that does for us is to attune us personally to those times when we just meet somebody casually at a party, maybe, and, hi, what do you do? But then we've still got that sense that even the most ordinary creature carries an amazing library of stories. And so?
Some conversations are like, well, like this.
I was visiting my godmother, who had an apartment in Rome. And I remembered getting myself, again, what I always like to do later on, lost in Rome, figuring if I walk long enough, I'll get my bearings again, find my way somewhere where it's familiar. And I always did. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here.
And that was my talk with Beata. It wandered all over the landscape, and at the end, it kind of made sense. Beata Hein was born in Germany at the end of the Second World War. She came to school in the U.S., married a scenic designer. They followed jobs all over the Midwest and South. Then she became a college professor, then moved to New York, and now teaches and does counseling in a New York City high school. It's an interesting, varied life, but this isn't so much about her life as about her reflections on her life. So instead of trying to map it out, I thought, well, for once, let's just wander.
I grew up in a town called Lindau, an old island town on the Lake Constance, which is truly in the center of Europe. I very early on became interested in geography. The first interest in this geography was, to me, the mystifying dial of the radio, which still listed not numbers, but cities. And there were cities like Warsaw, Moskva, Droitwich, Lisboa, Ljubljana, and these were marvelous words to me. And I looked them up and I spent quite a lot of time on my stomach looking at the atlas and seeing the rest of the world in relationship to Lindau and dreaming my way into the far reaches of the continents and sensing peculiarly at the same time that I truly was in the middle of a world, because Lindau, it has still the vestiges of Roman ruins. My father's office, my father was a medical doctor, his office was in a building dating back to the 12th century. Going to the bathroom downstairs was like going into the inner recesses of an old castle where the walls were a meter thick and the smell of old stone mildew was notable. I still have it in my nose. And so I had a sense of a kind of a vertical sense of life very early on, of the interweaving of personal history with the larger history. Also important is, I think, that I was born in 1945 in Germany. I've often thought I wasn't sure whether I was conceived as a last ditch of despair or the first ray of hope. But growing up in a beautiful, one of the most beautiful regions probably in Europe, certainly in Germany, and growing up in an area where I did not see the scars of war, but my learning very early on of the horrendous history and guilt and my parents' life, survival through that by the really skin of their teeth. I grew up very early with a sense of wanting to be part of a larger world. I wanted out, not to run away, but just to add more. I remember the very first trip, and it was in 1948. We went, my family and I, obviously my father got the permission to go to Munich. And we went to Munich, at that time still in ruins. And I remember the craters, and I remember walking with him through that city, along the edges of the craters. He liked to do balancing acts. He was a mountain climber. He would frequently upset my mother by going literally on the edge of things. He was always at the edge of things. I'm back there a lot, and I swim in the lake, and that's my real home. It's a Rip Van Winkle experience now. My brother married 100 yards from where he grew up, and the walnut tree is now a huge tree, and the magnolia bush that my mother planted is now a big magnolia tree. The landscape and the houses right where I grew up, nothing has changed. It's absolutely amazing. I can walk the same school route now, 50 years later, and it is the same place. The trees are taller. People I now, for years I recognized many people, even though they got older, but now they're moving from middle age into old age and the physiognomy changes. And now I think, do I know this person? I ran into her last summer and I didn't recognize her and it was awful. I felt embarrassed, but she was my neighbor and she went with me to school. And so last year I see her and here she is, a gray-haired woman. She was with another woman I did know. And this other friend said, don't you remember? This is Gitte Jordan. Gitte Jordan. And then everything came back. We used to walk to school together. We went midnight swimming together. And there were very few lights on the shore. And we had a few laughs swimming back, hoping that we would more or less get back to the same place where we have steps to get back out. And this was midnight swimming. So, yeah, that was Gitte Jordan. Yeah. I lived through a very turbulent time. I was here from 1964, so I lived through the turbulence in the South primarily of the civil rights movement. But on a personal level, I felt in many ways that I did experience a liberation in this country. I think America in the late 60s and 70s, undergoing the social turbulence of the civil rights movement, undergoing the Vietnam War and the denial of it thereafter, in terms of denying the real scars, trying to hide it, in that typical American manner of bravado, which comes sometimes awfully close to amnesia. And yet, it's a country that's very generous and has been very generous to me. I don't think there are many places where you can actually pick yourself up from nothing and really start all over again. And I did this once every 10 years. I don't think there are many places where you can do that. Certainly, I don't think in Germany, which is a place where expectations, social expectations, family expectations, root you in who you are. And I think in America, you are not judged in that way. And that, to me, is very refreshing. And so my coming to New York was, however, a sense, my need to come to New York was connected to a sense of, I didn't want to feel the stranger or the exotic or being asked, where are you from? Even though it's a very nice question. I wanted to be somewhere where practically everybody comes from somewhere else and is aware of that and knows that. When you get into America, into Middle America, as it were, people have forgotten that they all came from somewhere else. And while the newcomer is treated very nicely, I wanted to be in a place where that isn't so strange. And I feel at home in New York. I spent a little bit of time in Israel doing research. I lived in Jerusalem and it was very interesting. I don't know if alien is the word, but of course Jerusalem is a Near Eastern city. It's Arab in character. And so I would wander through the city every day. I wandered through a different part of the city. And I like to get lost in cities and places. It basically doesn't bother me. But in Jerusalem, there were times where I got very lost and I was the only woman. And the men were watching me. And I felt alien. And I kept walking because that was something comforting. And I figured, I keep on walking, I'll find my bearings sooner or later. And I would. But it was odd because in the morning I was dealing with something very familiar. And in the afternoon I was in this strange world where, however, one of my first encounters was on the very first visit in 79. I had just arrived that day, and as I was walking through the streets, I watched a woman being helped up the stairs by her son, middle-aged son. She was an older woman. And she said the phrase, which I hadn't heard since my father, and it translates, up helps you God, and down all the devils. And it's a mountain climber saying, because going down is much, much harder than going up. Rauf hilft dir Gott und runter alle Teufel. I hadn't heard this for decades. And here in this utterly alien place, the first night I was there, I would hear this saying. It hit my ears. That, I suppose, was in some ways a very paradoxical sense of feeling alien. And it was something because it had something to do with a part of my identity, which you carry around with you like a sometimes more secret little bag. I remember my journeys that I took by myself, because it was for me a testing of myself, tolerance of fear, making sure I took in everything that I could possibly take in. So journeys for me, first the mental journey with the radio dial, and then the atlas, and then the actual journeying, was to me for a long time a great pleasure. Interestingly enough, now I have no urge to do that. At this stage in my life, for some reason, I don't. A place that's in your head, you're fortunate if you can go back and physically experience it in the way that you did when you were young. And this is a phenomenon. Now I still swim out in the lake. I still go down the same steps, not at midnight anymore, but I swim out. And I'm fully aware of the fact that I'm looking at the same mountains, Switzerland across. And it's truly 50, almost 50 years later. Well, I'm 56, so I started swimming when I was 6. And by the time I was 10, 11, I swam long distances. And so here I am still doing that. And in many ways, I think swimming is my metaphor in life. It's swimming. And you better keep swimming or you drown.
On the east side of Manhattan, we wandered with Beata Hein.
Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by The Independent Eye with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Hitchhikers Guild. We depend on your generosity to make this show happen. And you can get a CD of any program you hear on the show or the special features in the Hitchhikers Audio Library, Nativity, The Descent of Inanna, others. Visit our website, www.independenteye.org.
And we invite you to share your own most vivid journey, whether it's a long, convoluted odyssey or just a short anecdote.
In November, we will be doing a series on a special kind of journey. We're talking with war veterans. Whatever your political opinions or your particular experience, if that was a significant time in your life, we'd like to hear from you.
This is Elizabeth Fuller.
And Conrad Bishop. Peace and joy.
My father would bicycle, had my brother as a little boy on the back. And at that time, you didn't strap anyone in. You just sat in that seat and you held on to whoever's in front of you and your legs dangled somewhere. And my father bicycled on the outside of a seawall towards the water. The trees are here. There's a bit of seawall about maybe 60 centimeters wide, and then it goes down to the water and rocks. And my father was bicycling with my brother on the back, to my brother's great delight, of course, on this outer edge. That was my father.